and welcome to another episode of Radio Warner. This is episode 127. The day today is March 26, 2018. I'm the co-host, Mark Ames, coming to you from Telescope Audio Studios in Greenpoint, Brooklyn. I'm on the line with the Warner, Gary Brecher, a.k.a. John Dolan. This will be the last show you'll be recording from the south of Portugal there, right, John?
Yeah, we go to Lisbon in a couple of days, and we bought a historical guide to Lisbon. So a lot of those expeditions we were talking about in the show before this one were launched and directed from the imperial headquarters in Lisbon, and I'm looking forward to seeing all that stuff.
Yeah, I know. After that last episode, it'll be great to be able to actually see. Yeah, are there? I think they had like an India. What did they have? Armories, and they had like where, if I remember right, you know, fortresses, warehouses, things like that. I mean, everything for all their Indian Ocean plunder.
Yeah, there's a lot of it is in the monastery Hieronymus, and one thing I have to check out is how much of this is reconstruction. Not that I'm an architecture pedant, but the thing is, if you do 18th century lit like I used to, the 1755 earthquake in Lisbon is one of the biggest events of the century. I mean, Voltaire wrote one of his classic essays on it, basically saying, ha ha, God hates Catholics. it completely leveled the city.
Right.
And it'll be interesting to see how well they've brought it back.
Yeah, we should do a show once about different KT events like that. Like, I was just reading about the early first rise of the Islamic Caliphate or the Arab, whatever you'd call it, you know, in the 7th century. And we'll talk about this more in another show, obviously. But one thing that was supposed to have had a big influence on the ability of hitherto not very powerful Arab tribes to come around and then conquer huge swaths of territory was a huge bubonic plague outbreak throughout much of Europe, Asia, Middle East, that just wiped out entire regions in the mid-late 6th century.
That's one of the things that was involved. The other one we heard about in our Byzantine episode, which was the endless war between the Persians and the Byzantines, which broke a long peace and left them both weak.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, there's a plague can really destroy people. People have the wrong idea about what kills a population. Going in there and trying to slaughter them all is the least efficient way. You want to use, if you really want genocide, blockade, artificial famine, and plague. Those are the ways to do it.
And cholera. Things like that, things like that. All right, on that horrible note, let's get to our our guest here. I'm really looking forward to. Actually, this is the third time we have him on. Tim Shorrock is joining us. We're very honored to have him again. Tim is the author of Spies for Hire, The Secret World of Intelligence Outsourcing. And this still stands by far as like the Bible, if you want to understand private contracting and the intelligence world, the military intelligence world. But Tim is also the finest journalist and blogger and, you know, analyst on the Koreas today. And in fact, I would say that, you know, what's happened over the last 2 years, certainly the last year, has really vindicated a lot of what Tim has been writing about and advocating for. Tim's long experience in South Korea, writing about South Korea, was an honorary citizen and hero of the honored in Gwangju. Let's invite him on or introduce him. Tim Shorrock, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. I'm really honored to be here too.
Yeah.
Thanks, Tim.
Yeah, thanks. I mean, Tim, so like, The first time we had you on, which was 2 years ago in the earlier Radio Warner days, and I mean, even going back then, obviously what we want to talk about is the surprising, very surprising moves to a potential rapprochement in the Koreas and even between the U.S. and North Korea. One of the main themes that you have been trying to push into the discourse on North Korea and the Koreas is the fact that the South Koreans exist as people, the North Koreans exist as people, and it's not just the U.S., you know, controlling South Korea and China controlling North Korea. I mean, obviously there are influences, but you've tried to inject some realism into the dialogue about how these, you know, that they're actual people there with their own culture, their own history, and their own agency that's been really denied. And you're really seeing this come out recently in the freak out over whether Trump should ever talk to Kim Jong-un and all this stuff. So I mean, first of all, just thanks for elucidating that. And the second thing is, I think from our first show with you, you've been talking before he became president about the current president, Moon Jae-in, and, you know, what a potentially positive force he could be. And then now it's coming into being. So I guess, first of all, before we even go, and then there's history and there are a lot of things we want to talk about here. But I think, first of all, the first question I want to ask is, could you kind of explain, you know, where we're at right now, what's gone on in the last few months, and you know, in these moves between South Korea and North Korea, and then Trump and North Korea, and bring us kind of up to date?
Sure. You know, first thing, the thing you said about, you know, South Korea not having an agency, or, you know, basically, you know, yes, South Korea exists, North Korea exists. There's 50 million people in South Korea, about 25 million in North Korea. There was an article by David Sanger in the New York Times the other day, one of these, you know, long, profound pieces on where U.S. policy is going to go and about the new hard line of, you know, Trump and Bolton. And they talked in there, you know, mentioned how, you know, Bolton brings this really hard line toward North Korea. But, like, the story didn't even mention that South and North Korea are developing this rapprochement. Mm-hmm. They didn't even talk about the fact that Moon is about to meet Kim Jong-un, and that, you know, Kim Jong-un reached out to South Korea in January. I mean, nothing. It's like that doesn't even exist. It's like North and South Korea don't even exist except in the U.S. mind as an enemy or whatever, that how the U.S. conceives of them. Mm-hmm. And it was just an astonishing, you know, example to me of how South Korea and North Korea just do not seem to play any kind of role in the thinking of U.S. elites. It's just another country to, you know, to push our policy through. And anyway, I wanted to mention that first. But, you know, where we're at is, you know, Moon Jae-in was elected, you know, about 10 months ago. And as I just, you know, I wrote this very long piece in The Nation that was published on Thursday, where I talked about, you know, how I met with him 2 days before his election. I happened to be the only American reporter who interviewed him during his campaign.
Yeah.
So that tells you something right there, right? Mm-hmm. And he was being called, you know, Josh Rogan of the Post, you know, when he was elected, said South Korea just elected an anti-American president. You know, all these people that know nothing about South Korea, and as if he's not anti-American at all. He wants an independent and strong South Korea. He was elected on this platform to kind of go back to the days of the sunshine policies of his predecessors, progressive presidents Kim Dae-jung and Noh Moo-hyun, who from about 1998 to 2008, you know, had, you know, did develop a kind of, engagement policies with North Korea and really decreased the tensions. Mm-hmm. And they started all kinds of projects together, economic, and there was always, you know, cultural and sports and diplomatic exchanges, academic exchanges. And then, you know, there was two successive administrations of very, very right-wing conservative presidents. The last one was impeached and is in jail. And the one before her was just arrested.
I just saw.
I mean, yeah. You know, totally, totally corrupt presidents. Yeah. And their line was, you know, the first one who was arrested the other day, Lee Myung-bak, he came to office, you know, basically denouncing any kind of this engagement policy, the sunshine policy, and, you know, ran against it. And immediately, you know, tensions escalated with North Korea under his leadership. And they kept escalating under Park Geun-hye, who was impeached. And so, you know, Moon Jae-in came to office saying, you know, it's, you know, those two presidents, the conservatives, have failed and have really endangered Korea by escalating tensions with North Korea. So a better policy would be engagement and to open negotiations again and to, you know, to get back to the days when they weren't, you know, seeing each other as just as enemies across the DMZ. And so that's what he ran on. And he, you know, he won by, you know, quite a comfortable margin. Mm-hmm. And a five candidates ran, and there was like three progressive to left candidates and two very right wing. And he got about 40% of the vote, and the right wing candidate that came closest to him got 20%. So, you know, he won a lot of votes and support with his policy. But as you know, we all know, like last year, 2017, you know, North Korea was testing and trying to perfect its weapon systems, its nuclear program, as they're what they see as a deterrence against the U.S. And even though Moon Jae-in reached out to them during in the beginning of the year when he became president, they didn't really respond at all until at the end, at you know, the very end of the year. And during the year, this is important for people to understand. There was like two kind of turning points in this. And, you know, of course, all last year that, you know, Trump was saying, we're going to totally destroy you and, mm-hmm. and, you know, et cetera, this very
fire
and fury, et cetera, yeah. You know, just terrible threats against North Korea. But, you know, during the summer, Moon Jae-in really, you know, he was getting very concerned about the possibility of a unilateral military strike, which was being discussed here very publicly in Washington.
And I'm sorry to cut you off here, but I was hearing also through other sources that Trump really was seriously talking about this or exploring it. You're in D.C. and you've got good connections or contacts in that world. I mean, same with you. This wasn't just public bluster posturing. Like, there was really, how serious was this, I guess is my question.
No, this was serious. Yeah. I mean, there was definite plans underway. And the thing that really kind of, you know, was took him over the edge, Moon Jae-in and the South Korean government, was reports that were actually, you know, got onto NBC News that the U.S. was planning unilateral strikes from B-1B bombers flying off the coast of North Korea in international airspace, where they could unleash, you know, missiles, cruise missiles and so on without South Korean involvement. Mm. And, you know, Moon Jae-in made this very clear, blunt statement. You know, there cannot be a, you know, the United States cannot go to war without, you know, consulting South Korea, and there cannot be a war in the Korean Peninsula. You know, this mm-hmm. is made a very clear, very emotional kind of statement, made that clear to Trump, too. I mean, he made calls to the White House. Mm. And so that was one. And, you know, that you know, I think
that's a big deal. I mean, you can't go to
deal.
You can't go to war there without having South Korea as your ally. I mean,
no. And, you that's, know, you I know mean, here you
insanity.
Here you have in wartime, the Korean military would be under the command of a U.S. general who's the head of the, you know, U.S. forces, Korea.
Right.
And that's the way that's the alliance structure. And so, you know, this was quite a statement for a Korean president to make. Mm-hmm. And I think it kind of, you know, I mean, the U.S. definitely heard that statement. Then, you know, there was all this, you know, focus on the North Korean missiles and the fact that they had launched, you know, ICBMs mm-hmm. That could reach the United States. You know, what they didn't accomplish was putting a nuclear warhead on a missile that could hit the United States, and building a reentry system where it could come into the atmosphere and hit a target. Mm-hmm. And what they did was they tested, of course, the last year they tested another bomb, a hydrogen bomb. Mm-hmm. But they tested, you know, a number of missiles, and they tested three ICBMs that were quite successful tests, flew thousands of miles, enough to hit the United States. I mean, they went way high and then went down, so they didn't stretch that line all the way to the U.S., but they, right. you know, they landed in waters in Asia. But they stopped short of developing a, you know, fully developed nuclear capable mm-hmm. system. And then they said publicly, Kim Jong-un declared in December that they had completed their state nuclear force. And in January, he did this reach out to South Korea. And so, and through their, you know, North Korean dialogue with, you know, former U.S. officials that happened on a kind of rolling basis, you know, frequently over the years. There, last year, there was, you know, four or five such meetings where North Korean foreign affairs people meet with U.S. former U.S. officials and people that are specialists in negotiations and so on. Mm-hmm. And the North Koreans passed the word that, you know, yes, the way they see it is they've completed their state nuclear force. They're not going to be testing anymore, and they're going to focus is going to be on the economy. They think they have a deterrent system. And so that message was definitely heard by the CIA and the top national security people, as I outlined in this Nation piece that's mm-hmm. up right now. And so that made a big difference in terms of, like, you know, Moon Jae-in and how it responded to when Kim Jong-un reached out in January 1st and said they would take part in the Olympics. And then, you know, they sent this very high delegation. You know, he sent his own sister, who's like a top aide to Kim Jong-un. And he sent, you know, very high officials at the beginning of the Olympics and the end of the Olympics, the highest level delegation ever to be in South Korea from North Korea since the end of the Korean War. Hmm. And of course, you know, if you were watching like NBC at the time,
yeah,
like Richard Engel,
yeah,
you know, he's like, oh, this, you know, they're just trying to trick us. And right. You know, just all this militaristic talk.
And South Korea misses the Japanese colonial period. They really developed. You remember that one too?
That
was another guy, but yeah.
the guy from Kissinger Associates was on NBC and they had to fire him. You know, I had a kind of funny moment during the Olympics, because when that happened, I quick did some research on this guy, and I found out he was on the board of Starbucks. And it turns out that Starbucks has the largest, you know, coffee shop in the world is in Seoul. It's a gigantic Starbucks there. And my tweet went viral about how he was on the board, and all these Koreans started barraging Starbucks with telephone calls and stuff. And it got into like the Korean business news, you know, through this tweet by Twin Kim Sorok, you know. I guess Starbucks would probably not be very happy with me, but it's you know, people were really pissed at that.
Well, it's insane. I mean,
yeah. And you know, then of course, you know, Pence was just you know, an idiot, and he was so rude. He was so rude to both his hosts and the North Koreans that, you know, there was a planned meeting with the North Korean delegation under Pence, but they can't, like 2 hours before the meeting, they canceled. I mean, all he was going to do was like read them the riot act. Right. So why should they sit through that?
I'm thinking about the idea of deterrent, and basically your thesis is North Korea wanted to wait until it felt it had a credible deterrent before reentering serious negotiations, right? And if they were thinking solely in terms of the Korean Peninsula, then you wouldn't need an ICBM. There are much simpler ways to deliver nuclear weapons, well, really anywhere on the southern half of the peninsula, to U.S. bases there, or even to Japan. So the way they see it, it seems to imply an understanding that the U.S. is what needs to be deterred, and absolutely, that the only thing that would deter them is an attack on their own mainland.
Mm. And attacks, the ability to attack, you know, U.S. bases in Japan and Okinawa and South
Guam.
Korea. And Guam, yeah. So, like, the one, you know, time he said we're going to launch a missile towards something when he was specific, Kim Jong-un, was when he talked about Guam. And, of course, Guam is where these B-1Bs are based.
Right.
And, you know, last year they did two flights. The U.S. Pentagon did two flights of B-1Bs, that there's this northern limit line that extends out from the DMZ into the sea on the west coast of Korea. And that northern limit line is seen as like, you know, U.S. planes should never, no, you know, South Korean or U.S. planes should fly above that line. It's seen as very provocative. And they did it.
Mm.
And, you know, they probably did it to sort of test the North Korean radar system and all that. But it was that was like really, you know, a provocative move by the U.S. So, you know, he said, like Kim Jong-un said, well, okay, we'll shoot a missile toward Guam. And then there was all this freak out in the media. He's going to attack Guam and, you know, all this. And then Kim Jong-un said, okay, we'll pull back from that and we'll see what the U.S. does in the next set of military exercises, which turned out to be just as large as any exercises held before. And so they continued their testing. But they, as I said, they stopped short of, you know, building a completely capable nuclear system. Of course, you know, these ICBMs they have could easily hit any of these, you know, U.S. bases around there with conventional weapons. So they don't have to have nuclear weapons on them. But so they stopped short. And I think that was the message that was delivered probably privately through, you know, backdoor channels to the U.S. from North Korea. So then. You know, the U.S. side heard it, and it, like, you know, Pompeo, who was still head of the CIA, and he gave a speech in January where, if you read it now in light of what we know, it's clear to me that he understood this message that they had gotten from the North Koreans, that they had stopped short, and that there were that in other words, they were really negotiating from a position of strength to be able to have this this deterrent. So. You know, in these negotiations they had with the Moon Jae-in government, they, you know, first they extended an invitation for Moon to meet with Kim, another summit, and Kim decided, you know, he wanted to have some movement on the nuclear issue before he agreed to that. So he sent his delegation, his national security advisor and intelligence chief, to North Korea. And the North Koreans told them that, you know, one, they want to talk to the United States, and two, they will talk about denuclearization issues. And that was very key, of course, to the U.S., to get the U.S. to talk. And so that was the message delivered, you know, at the White House when these two Korean officials, you know, spoke from the driveway of the White House, to the total shock and astonishment and disbelief of the entire U.S. media and all these little national security North Korea experts that have suddenly sprouted, you know, in, over the last year, you know, and, you know, from Rachel Maddow down to, the, you know, the, all these think tanks, you know, how could this possibly Trump meet Kim? You know, how ridiculous. But, you know, it's going to happen. I mean, it's the U.S. officials have made clear that's going to happen. And Kim, the thing, the point is, I think the most important point is that Kim Jong-un and Moon Jae-in are moving ahead on rapprochement between North and South Korea. They want to really, you know, ease the tensions. And, you know, North Korea, you know, wants to end or, you know, phase out the sanctions that have been imposed on them. And so, you know, they too welcome the chance of going back to those days of the sunshine policies.
Well, let me just ask you, as somebody who hasn't lived in the U.S. for a long time, how does Bolton fit into that? I mean, I saw the strange phenomenon you're talking about, that is self-described liberal America getting furious at the idea of an American president negotiating with North Korea, which was weird enough. But then that president who's agreed to do this suddenly appoints Bolton, and Bolton is a pretty simple person. Like, you see that imitation Teddy Roosevelt mustache and you know, okay, he wants to bomb somebody. So how does that fit in?
Well, it's, you know, I think everybody looking at this is still trying to figure that out. My sense is that, you know, he fired Tillerson, right? Tillerson was Secretary of State, was the guy who was kind of leading the diplomatic, was taking the diplomatic lead with North Korea.
Right. Didn't Tillerson
and he actually say wasn't
something
bad.
That I heard? I heard Tillerson say something that was remarkable, and I suddenly realized I haven't heard anybody else say that before from the U.S. high-level administration, which was, we're not your enemy. Saying that to North Korea seemed very surprising.
Well, it's been said before, but he was, of course, the only guy in the Trump administration to say this. You know, no regime change, you know, that kind of thing. No, no attempt to overthrow your government and so on. And we want to be, you know, we want to talk and we want and you know, Tillerson spoke a couple times about, you know, talks without preconditions. But he didn't really, I think he was kind of eclipsed mm-hmm. in the Korea policy by Pompeo and the CIA. Mm-hmm. And the thing is, like, here's how I see Bolton and the policy working is that, you know, I think, you know, Trump has been infatuated with Bolton, except for his mustache. he almost came into the Trump administration, you know, a year ago. Mm-hmm. But the reports then were Trump just didn't see him with his mustache, you know, being Secretary of State or something. You know how Trump is, yes. with, you know, yeah. as if he looks
deep
like
man.
President.
Yeah, exactly.
But anyway,
the mustache should be on top of the head, like Trump's, you know.
Yeah, apparently or something. But he, Trump watches Fox 24/7, so, you know, mm-hmm. and Bolton has been on 24/7 right. practically in terms of Korea. So, yeah, like, he loves this guy's bluster. Mm-hmm. And so, like, but I think that, you know, before Bolton came on, he fired Tillerson and made clear that Pompeo was going to become the next Secretary of State. And I think that made clear also that the CIA is in charge of this initiative. Mm. And you know, there was a story that came out in the New York Times about 10 days ago that was clearly a manufactured leak, made sure the New York Times got this story, that the CIA and Pompeo have been in touch with Kim Jong-chol, who is the head of North Korean intelligence. Mm. And he is a very high-level person in the Korean Workers' Party, responsible for policies with South Korea, very knowledgeable guy about the U.S. as well. He's like basically, you know, the interlocutor with Pompeo now, along with the chief of South Korean intelligence. Hmm. So I think they're kind of all three countries are kind of, putting their intelligence people in charge of this and kind of cutting out the diplomats. Mm-hmm. I mean, the diplomats, of course, are going to be involved. And so the way I see it here is the CIA is going to be kind of running the North Korea policy. And, you know, it's like, you know, a year ago, just after Moon was elected president in South Korea, the CIA set up its first Korea Mission Center. And, you know, they've been staffing and, you know, they bring in, you know, analysts and operatives that, you know, sit work alongside each other. But they really focus on North Korea in that mission center. And, you know, it's been kind of unusual in the sense that, you know, usually the CIA's centers like that, you know, the people aren't very public. You know, you don't see them at forums or hear about them in the media, but this CIA mission center has been kind of public, and there's been a few public forums here where both Pompeo and leaders from that mission center spoke publicly. So I think the CIA has kind of maneuvered itself, and, you know, with Trump's blessing, apparently, to sort of be in charge. And then I think, as I've been telling people in the last couple of days, I think Bolton was brought in, you know, to kind of, you know, be a sort of like bad cop to the North Koreans, right? But yeah. I think his main purpose is to screw up the agreement with Iran. Mm. I mean, you know, Bolton has these connections with these fanatic, you know, right, you know.
The MEK. He also, that terrorist group, we did a show on those guys, yeah.
So, you know, I think, you know, and of course, if they unravel the Iran agreement, I mean, why would North Korea negotiate with them? And a lot of it doesn't make sense. But where I'm thinking now is that it's sort of like U.S. intelligence is going to be carrying the water in terms of North Korea and even doing a fair amount of the negotiation. And of course, if they get to the point where there is a denuclearization agreement, then, of course, you know, U.S. intelligence assets become very, you know, important in terms of monitoring compliance and verification and so on. You know, the overhead imagery and surveillance that U.S. intelligence has. Mm. So in a way, it's sort of there's a certain logic of it you know, to me. Mm-hmm. But we don't know. You know, we don't know what, you know, Bolton's going to do. In the last couple of days, he's been saying a lot of stupid things like, you know, well, you know, North Korea's just in these negotiations to, you know, the regular line, like they're.
Yeah, to gain time to.
Gain time to build their weapon systems. Yeah. And that's actually opposite of what's the truth. The mm-hmm. truth is they've stopped testing.
Right. And is it possible that Bolton is a sop to the right wing base that Trump knows will be offended if he does do some deal with North Korea?
So he's just kind of a
noise machine?
Yeah, like, so if you can get a deal with North Korea with Bolton on board, then you can get a deal with anybody, right?
So only Nixon can go to China, that mm-hmm. kind of water.
That kind of thinking, yeah. And I think, you know, I think that's the way it's going. I mean, you know, he could really screw things up. But on the other hand, you know, Trump, like all, you know, the last, you know, before all these Olympics truce happened and these talks happened in the last part of the last year, you know, Trump was being told by McMaster, H.R. McMaster, who we also fired, that McMaster was talking about this so-called bloody nose strike on North Korea. How they could somehow, you know, attack North Korea and North Korea would not, you know, respond militarily, and they could get away with it. And this idea was really being promoted here by primarily, you know, McMaster and his people. And of course, that was the advice he was giving Trump. But you know, Trump fired him. So Trump doesn't always, you know, we know Trump doesn't. I guess he rarely listens to his own people, right? So why would he listen to Bolton more than anyone else? You know, I mean, Bolton.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. Like, you can't be more warmongering on North Korea than McMaster's. Well, I guess you could be for, you know, immediate full nuclear strike, but as a general rule, McMaster was so far to the warmongering right on North Korea, which isn't talked about much, that. This. Bolton on this particular issue is not out of league on that. Yeah.
Although his last, you know, he gave a speech, you know, 2 or 3 weeks before this happened, where he was talking about, you know, going way beyond McMaster's proposals to, like, you know, massive military strikes on North Korea, like taking out all their artillery on the DMZ and then, you know, going after all their missile sites and then their nuclear sites. Okay. But, you know, as the Pentagon said about 6 months ago, if the U.S. wants to do a military strike and take out the nuclear facilities, it's going to take a U.S. ground invasion. Mm-hmm. And guess what? The Pentagon does not want to do a ground invasion of North Korea. Yeah.
No, we've seen a pattern over the years we've been doing the show where the U.S. is in a very strange place politically, where it's mainly politicians, often with a very chicken hawk background, who talk about these insane military adventures, and it's usually very highly placed military brass who say that's not going to work.
Exactly,
you can't just invade Iran. Have you looked at a map? Yeah, you know what it means to invade Iran.
Yeah, look what happened in, you know, April 1980 when those helicopters went in to rescue them. I mean, it's just massacre in the desert, right? Yeah.
So have you talked to American military people? Do they have any enthusiasm for war with North Korea, or what's their
attitude? Peace, for that matter?
Well, I do, yes. And you know, basically what a lot of people say, you know, military people, and you hear this kind of echo too in Secretary of Defense Mattis, of course, you know, is a Marine general, right? You know, this would be like the worst kind of fighting you can ever imagine. I mean, it would be terrible. And they know what happened during the Korean War. Right. You know, Korean Peninsula is very mountainous. Mm-hmm. It's really cold in the winter. And, you know, the fighting during the Korean War was terrible. I mean, I think we talked about this earlier in the previous shows, like, how the U.S. Marines, you know, got massacred.
The 1st Marine Division, the best unit in the American Armed Forces when you're talking about infantry, and just decimated.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It was just, you know, and they had a, you know, they withdrew, but they just lost thousands and thousands of soldiers. And, you know, they remember that. And so there's not enthusiasm. I mean, they do these exercises. I mean, all military, that's what they do. They have to be ready, right? for anything and prepared, but they're not interested in a war. And you hear this from people within the military, and you hear it from the highest levels of the Pentagon. And so it is these kind of these think tank people and all these chicken hawks like Bolton, you know, he wouldn't go to Vietnam, you know, we're talking about this stuff. People have never seen this kind of warfare.
Mm-hmm. Right. So just real quickly for listeners here, and we'll post this also when we post the show, we'll post a link to it. But the Nation article that Tim is referencing is the headline is South Korean President Moon's gamble for peace with North Korea has paid off. And the subheader is, but the diplomatic process will be managed by U.S. and Korean spy agencies. And that's such an interesting observation, too, because, you know, first you had Tillerson for a little over a year and at the State Department. And basically, and I've heard this from many sources in and then outside. I mean, he gutted a lot of the State Department, it sounds like. And and meanwhile, it seems like the CIA intelligence has been pretty well taken care of and beefed up under Trump. And now you basically have the CIA man taking over, you know, the State Department. So they're kind of sidelining, which is sort of an, I mean, the right, certainly the old right, has not really liked the diplomatic service for quite a long time. But it would really be interesting, and I don't know how this will play out, but it would be interesting if they actually wind up, you know, bringing an end to a long simmering, you know, war that's this would be what, after 60, 70 years almost, if Pompeo is actually able to bring an end to this war.
I mean, that's what I tell these people on the left, you know, that are like appalled by this Trump Kim meeting. I mean, like, what, you're going to be against an attempt to, you know, bring peace to a peninsula that's been, you know, virtually a war for 70 years. Come on.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Well, you know what? Just because he's Trump, you're going to be against it. You know, well, look at Obama. What did he do? Nothing. He made it worse.
Yeah, yeah. Obama. We talked about this on the previous show with you, but Obama came to office, and I think you point this out in your article too. He came to office promising in 2008 to have a completely new and different approach, and just sort of fell back on the status quo of missing every opportunity potentially to maybe reach out to North Korea, maybe start cutting peace deals, listening to their any signals they were getting, and just sort of go with what was easiest, which is maintain maximum hostility there, right?
They also had this assumption that it was going to collapse. You know, it was
right.
Stupid assumption. He went real big on the cyber war too,
right.
Obama did. He really expanded that.
Right.
And of course, that made things much worse. But, you know, he never kept his – he said he was going to talk to the leaders of North Korea. He talked to the leaders of Iran, but never North Korea. And he was talked out of this by all his, you know, neocon national security guys.
Right.
But, you know, the other thing about the CIA is that I think, you know, like there's all these people like, you know, want regime change in North Korea. I think Bolton was one of them, is one of them, right?
Mm-hmm.
But, like, the CIA – you know, I think they know, and I was told this by one of the people that I interviewed for that article, who does talk regularly to people inside the agency, is that they know darn well that there's no kind of mass opposition in North Korea to Kim Jong-un. I mean, this idea that, you know, you can break the elites away from, you know, the Kim family and the core government there and, you know, somehow, you know, people would welcome U.S. intervention or something. It's insane.
It's amazing how that never dies. Right? Yeah, that
never dies.
That idea in so many areas. It's like every Russian, every North Korean, everybody is dying to be a Nebraskan, you know, or something. Like, no, they're
right.
You know, it's not like
that.
And
as if South Koreans would want the U.S. to somehow, you know, take over North Korea. Come on.
Right.
You know, if anything, if they're, you know, see, the one danger here is that they negotiate and they botch the whole thing.
Yes.
And, you know, they're just come in like Pence did and you just chew them out and give them warning after warning, which is kind of seems like what Bolton wants to do. And then they say, well, see, we tried negotiations, so now we're going to do war.
Right.
But I actually think that the momentum is where the Koreas, like South Korea and North Korea. I mean, they're meeting in a few days and they're going to determine, you know, because, you know, Moon and Kim are meeting in April, in Panmunjom for the first North-South summit since 2008 in 10 years. So, you know, they're moving forward. And, and I think, you know, and South Korean politicians have been here the last week or so, and they're realizing that, like I tweeted some about this morning, like they realize the U.S. elites don't give a rat's ass about this peace process in Korea. Mm-hmm. You know, they just don't care.
They're offended by it, if anything.
They care. This was the point of your other article for the Baffler, the peace is Armageddon, the liberal freakout over Kim Jong-un, that they care in the sense that it annoys them. Because
it annoys them.
Yeah. Everything is immediately reduced to Trump or anti-Trump. And if you're in favor of someone making a stab at peace in Korea, then you must be at the very least a Trumpy, if not a Russian agent in some way.
Or a Nazi.
And actually Maddow began to bring in the Russian connection too, because, you know, the Russians are close to North Korea.
What else could she do?
Yeah. And, you know, they've also been helping them evade the sanctions and so on. So Russia's behind this. You know, Russia's actually been playing kind of a minor role here. That I actually think they could play a very important role. Once, you know, I think the U.S. is going to need, you know, support of other countries. You know, like you know, the European, like Sweden, which represents U.S. interests in North Korea, is pretty involved. You know, they've been involved in like you know, being communication between North and South Korea. The North Korean foreign minister last week was in Sweden. Which was pretty significant, because I think he was discussing with them some ideas of possibly where the Trump-Kim summit may happen, and I think, you know, that's the role of these countries like that, you know, could be critical. And so you know, I think Russia could play a role there, because they're very interested in, you know, economic development in that part of Russia, the Pacific part. And, you know, like they've been talking for years about oil pipeline that could go through North and South Korea from their fields in, you know, Siberia, and that they could export it through, you know, Korean ports. So, you know, there's a lot that could happen with a peace process. I mean, I had this, you know, I heard this astonishing speech by the former Secretary of Defense, Bill Perry, just after this announcement was made about 10 days ago. And, you know, he was saying how, there's this furor, as you know, about U.S. bases in Okinawa, right? And there's this one base, Futenma, the Marine base at Futenma, that's been the focus of this anger by Okinawan people. And Futenma, this is what Perry was saying. The U.S. forces in Futenma are there to respond instantaneously to a North Korean attack on South Korea and to intervene immediately to stop North Korean forces from getting to Seoul if there's ever that kind of invasion. So if there's peace in Korea, you don't need the U.S. forces, the forward base in Futenma.
So you don't need to keep continually provoking the Okinawans with the sort of outrageous crimes that occasionally happen with American service people, and you could close the base or transfer them.
Close the base. You could move those people out. You wouldn't have to build this big expanded base in northern Okinawa that's making people there so angry, you know? So there are ramifications here that go, you know, that do go beyond Korea. But, I mean, getting a peace in Korea by itself would be huge. And I think it's important to note that, you know, for almost all year last year, if you remember, all the talk was, you know, you know, we have to put pressure on China. China's the one that's going to bring North Korea to the table. You know, they're going to force it. No, that didn't happen. It's more like it's South Korea is going to help North Korea negotiate with the U.S. And I think that's really, really, you know, important and significant. And, you know, that's where this momentum is coming from.
Although, I saw a really interesting news article from, I think, South China Morning Post or something like that, that had an odd similarity to the U.S. take that you're mentioning. And the theme was, China still has a role here, you know.
Hello, we're over here. You know?
Yeah.
But, like, you know, the North Koreans, I mean, they have, there's a lot of animosity between China and North Korea. And
well, as you pointed out, Kim Jong-un executed a bunch of what he called Chinese agents in his general staff, right? Or spies.
Including his own uncle.
Right.
Who was like very senior military guy who was doing all these economic deals between North Korea and China.
Right.
And I remember a few years ago, I was talking to this Joe Detrani, who's this former CIA guy, who I actually interviewed to that Nation article the other day. Mm-hmm. And I talked to him a few years ago, right after Uncle John was executed. And I talked to him then because I thought, and I got confirmation from him that, that was very damaging to the U.S. outreach to North Korea, because the U.S. outreach was going through these China people, mm-hmm. these North Korean officials that were in touch with China. In other words, the U.S. Link was through China. And like I think Kim Jong-un, wanted to have his own links and not have it through the Chinese.
Right.
So I think that all this was, very marks a very profound shift in how things are going to be happening in Korea. And the other thing that Kim Jong-un, in his language and the officials that came down, they said to Kim, "We want to solve this, on our own as Koreans." Mm-hmm. And that carries a lot of weight with Koreans, in South Korea. It's right. Like, okay, we're going to resolve this by ourselves without foreign intervention. Korea's been the subject of foreign yes. intervention since, centuries,
yes.
and especially since, going back to our beginning of our conversation about Roosevelt, right?
Mm-hmm.
The 1905 agreement between that ended the Japanese war with Russia,
right.
U.S. ceded Korean control over Japanese control over Korea, and Japanese recognized U.S. control over the Philippines. So it
right.
goes way back to those, early of the last century.
Right. Yeah, we did an episode.
One thing I've always
go ahead, sorry.
Yeah, sorry, we did an episode on the Imjin Wars,
yeah.
Yeah,
which was
and
pretty bloody.
That was remarkable. Yeah. You can see how the need for Korean independence and to be the urge to be free of foreign domination would echo the memory of that really horrific campaign in southern Korea toward the end of the Imjin Wars.
Yeah, they've been suffering through that stuff for a long time, and I think that's unification is far off, but I think there can be a period where North and South Korea can really, work together to, defuse crisis and to move ahead and allow North Korea to develop a better economy for its people.
Mm-hmm.
One question that's probably naive, but I've always wanted to ask someone who really knows. We tend to use the leader's name as sort of a metonymy for the whole leadership. And I'm wondering if that's the case here. That is, when we say Kim wants to do this, are we actually talking about Kim Jong-un individually, or are we talking about someone who represents a consensus?
We are talking about Kim Jong-un.
Okay.
If you notice, two Sundays ago, when the South Korean foreign minister was here, Kam, she gave this interview on CBS Sunday Morning or the Sunday Morning Show, and because after the unbelief of people about this North Trump agreeing to a meeting, then it was like, well, why hasn't North Korea said anything to the United States, and can we really trust what the South Koreans said? And she said this was the first time ever that a North Korean leader had communicated this kind of pledge, this kind of guarantee that they would talk about denuclearization. And she said, when it comes right from the leader, that's, mm-hmm. The kind of the seal of approval. Right.
Right.
And that's very, very, that was like, it never happened before in that kind of way. And then, when I talked to Korean reporters here, who were briefed by the Korean, South Korean delegation from here, basically that's what they said. They said, In North Korea, even under its constitution, for good or bad, this Kim family is seen as, that is the voice of authority, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so when even under their constitution, it's sort of like a, it was explained to me, it's like they, you know, it's like a law, you know, what he says goes. And so, you know, he's not going to make a 180. And I think the South Koreans, this idea that's also been promoted by a lot of liberals, that somehow the South Koreans, you know, Moon would like communicate this promise and this guarantee that they would talk about denuclearization, you know, without, you know, really being sure about that, is ridiculous. You know, Moon Jae-in would not risk his entire presidency and leadership of South Korea, you know, for some like, you know, promise that it was weak or he wasn't sure of. I mean, that's just absurd for people to talk like that. Mm-hmm. And it just shows you how little respect, you know, even the most liberal of our, you know, commentators have about Korea, North and South. It's just so little respect for that country.
Well, lately it's almost like, especially the liberals.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, especially the liberals, yeah. You know? I mean, Fox is all on board. Of course, they're on board with everything Trump does, right?
Yeah.
But like someone put together a, you know, a bunch of clips from Fox about, you know, oh, this is so great and blah, blah, blah. And then, you know, going back to when anyone talked about in the past about negotiating with North Korea, how can you negotiate with a dictator? You know, Fox made a 180, but all these liberals, it's still, I mean, you know, MSNBC, you know, the night of the big announcement, that's when, you know, Rachel Maddow lashed out about, you know, no president has ever done this. And that by itself had to be a reason not to do it, right?
Yes.
And what does Chris Hayes have on his show? He has Stormy Daniels, you know, so it's just, and this is like the most earth-shaking event to happen in Korea for, you know, decades. Yeah. And that's what they have. You know,
I mean, just last summer, and I remember even my mother calling me scared that, you know, this weekend I'm being told there's going to be a nuclear war. I mean, all the networks were scaring the hell out of everybody.
Yep.
About impending. Yeah. You know, my wife even once says, is this for real? You know, on CNN on. And then the next, and suddenly now there's a potential for peace. And it's like, oh, how dare he? Peace.
Yeah, right. You know?
Yeah. I mean, I get emails saying, aren't you scared there's going to be a nuclear war? And I have to say, well, no, I've lived with, you know, the Korean about to go off thing that never goes off for most of my life. So I would just on an intuitive basis, I would say probably not. And it upsets people. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know where they're getting it from, but somehow they've been convinced that there has to be an apocalyptic war right now.
Well, I would love to put together, I have some clips of him on my phone because I every time Richard Engel gets parachuted into South Korea, he just parrots this militaristic line. You know, it's really grotesque. But I'd love to put together his clips because, you know, it's like liberal NBC, right? It's probably promoted the most, you know, war-focused reporting on North Korea of any network. Even Fox, mm-hmm. it's been awful. And like, if you guys were getting emails like that, imagine what I was getting last year, especially when I was in Korea, right? Mm. You know, I was getting like emails from, you know, messages from people who follow me on Facebook and other places, you know,
go underground, articles, like, Tim, go underground.
my son is in Seoul. Should I, you know, have him come home? And I'm like, look, you know, no, there's not going to be a war. And, you know, just rest easy. You know, South Koreans are going to take care of this and don't be so worried. But I mean, yeah, people were really frightened that there was going to be a war. Then suddenly there's a chance that maybe not. And so then they start sniping, you know. Because
I'm going to read a little bit from your piece here, Tim. First, you know, when this announcement first came out that Trump talked about meeting with Kim Jong-il, Rachel Maddow's show is now largely devoted to her obsessive focus on Mueller's Russia probe. And this is, you know, it's funny how our areas, I mean, there's so much crossover, Tim, in terms of, it turns out the liberals have turned into like the loony hawks, both on Russia and on North Korea. And like also just the amount of kind of DC think tank, you know, corrupt think tank propaganda that comes out about both. It's sort of different sorts of propaganda, but it's just overwhelming. It's insane sometimes. Anyway, I'm going to keep reading here. Maddow delivered, speaking directly to her audience in the grave tone she reserves for the most serious issues, Maddow delivered a somber sermon. Why has no sitting president ever met with a leader from North Korea? Shouldn't I take this to mean this is a risky and unwise move? But this is the president we have, and he said yes to North Korea. I know when she talks about Russia, she always does these leading questions. Very Glenn Beck. Why is there this line from this tweet leading to this line over there? If I'm not mistaken, that proves that, you know, Putin is actually in the White House controlling everything. maybe not. I'm just saying.
Just saying.
Yeah. And I want to read another part here. Also, after Trump accepted the invitation to meet with North Korea, that he would meet Kim Jong-un by May to achieve permanent denuclearization, within minutes, the New York Times resident hand-wringer Nicholas Kristof, God, it's amazing.
Good epithet for Christoph, by the way.
I know. Was tweeting like Chicken Little, quote, "I'm all for direct talks." When it starts off with that, you know that the next part's going to be really awful, right? "I'm all for direct talks, but starting with a summit seems to me a very dangerous gamble and a gift to North Korea." And these guys talk like they're in some really exclusive fraternity or country club, and you know, if you let this dangerous nerd into your club, it's gonna kind of ruin the reputation of your country club, and you know, or something. It's very strange how they look at this. It's all about like cliques and clubs.
What follows in Christoph's article, as Tim quotes it, is very common, which is they're gonna play Trump. You say Christoph wrote despairingly that the meeting, quote, "strikes me as a dangerous gamble and a bad idea. I'm afraid that North Korea may be playing Trump."
Yes.
And what most irks me from NYT people is that sudden attempt to be streety. Oh, they're playing us. Are we too streetwise for that?
Yeah.
And
that Trump's playing us. And that's the thing that the establishment can't handle more than anything. It's like Trump's playing us and Putin's playing Trump. And Trump's playing us, and Kim's playing Trump. Like, you know, it's real 80-dimensional, hard-boiled detective fiction.
They just think of every reason, you know, not to have this. And, you know, the idea of, you know, somehow North Korea could possibly be on equal footing with the United States, what a horrible idea.
Yes.
You know, it's just like they just cannot deal with this at all, and so they just have to dismiss. And I have to add, like, by the way, that piece was in the Baffler, and you know, after I tweeted about it and posted that article, I got so many, you know, angry tweets from these
really good
from these Rachel Maddow people. Like, you know, one guy said, you know, "well, she is, here's your Wikipedia bio, you know, and what's your bio and all this stuff." Like,
her bio beats your bio by a mile.
I said, "well, I happen to have one. It wasn't me that did it, but like, so what if she's a Rhodes Scholar? She's an idiot on this issue. You know, she's also a militarist.
Yeah,
she's always been believed. You know, whatever the militarists say, she'll go for that."
Well, one of Mark's themes over the last couple of years we've been doing the show is just shock at how people like Maddow, especially Maddow, in fact, have suddenly turned into these groveling worshippers of these coup-making intel agencies
that
you would have thought they would oppose.
Right. But the logic of what's going on, they should applaud the fact that the CIA is in charge of this Korea, you know, policy. But, you know, they don't think that far.
No, I think they're all, their love for the CIA is this hope, and I've seen this from so many once sane liberals, that the CIA will somehow affect a coup d'etat and overthrow Trump and do what? I don't know, put Pence in so that we'll have like a theocracy instead of a lunocracy. I don't know. The other thing that happened, which was kind of strange, was so Trump tweeted this out, and that first there was the freak out, oh, we're going to get played and it's terrible. Then there was this kind of brief lull, and then you had all these sort of neocons and liberal establishment media people saying, "well, we haven't heard anything since, so this probably just means it's another one of Trump's, you know, just a whim on a tweet, and he's actually not going to meet him. And now I'm getting good word. Like, I saw this from Josh Marshall. I mean, you quote here Jonathan Chait saying, the major policy change Trump announced appears to be completely moot because he plays the president on television, but isn't really president. Like, a lot of really sneery talk.
Yeah.
And then shortly afterwards, Trump's people came out and said, no, this is actually going to happen. And yeah, again, yeah, go ahead.
Chait's article was amazing because, like, they had, you know, the day after the big announcement at the White House, you know, the White House press corps, you know, comes hungry for meat, red meat at the, you know, the press briefing in the at the White House. And, you know, Sarah Sanders said something about, you know, we're going to insist on, you know, denuclearization, or she seemed to hedge on the fact that this meeting was taking place. So that's where Chait wrote. He actually, a line was cut out of the article where he actually said, you know, obviously this meeting isn't going to happen. You know, it's like, and then like 40 minutes later, someone comes on, you know, some high ranking official there told the Wall Street Journal, yes, this meeting is happening. Yes, it's going on, you know. So the reporters were so desperate to like, you know, completely, you know, take the teeth out of the story the next day and like deny it that it had ever happened. It was just another foolish, you know, move by North Korea. But again, it reflects this complete lack of respect or even knowledge of what's going on in Korea, you know?
Right.
I mean, it's just, it really is.
No, that's a great point.
So, I mean, it's just so insulting and so arrogant to look at Korea like just some minor player. Now, like I said, you know, this Times article the other day, it's like, it's not even happening. We're not even, there's not even any discussion about this inter-Korea process.
It's really chauvinistic. I mean, it's incredibly chauvinistic. And it's, you know, again, the surprising to see liberals and centrists leading the chauvinism on Korea. And, you know, we can all agree, or certainly any of us who are left of Trump, which is not hard to be, or on the left, that Trump's immigration policy is, you know, is criminal, and his policies on labor and environment and in certain theaters in the world, you know, in Syria and Yemen and some other places, they're just really awful. Israel, really awful. But that doesn't mean that this one has to be awful. Also, it looks like there is a chance, at least, that something good could come out of this. Why oppose it? Why freak out? I think because so much of this is also, Tim, and you're there in D.C., so much of this is also like about manners or, you know, the way you comport yourself. And I mean, this is one of the big, you know, as they call it, intractable conflicts. And the idea that this really ill-mannered, crude scumbag from outside of the kind of political media establishment might solve one problem despite screwing everything else up, but might solve this problem. It so deeply offends them. It's almost like a threat to their hold on power because the way that a lot of media talk about Trump, it's sort of like somebody with these man who doesn't have our manners and our mannerisms cannot possibly do any good. And cannot possibly succeed. You know, and so they deeply don't want this to succeed, which is pretty clear to me. They don't want it to succeed.
I mean, that's the logic of Maddow's invocation of the sacred pantheon of American presidents. Like, George W. Bush.
Let's go back. Let's go back through that pantheon,
Yeah.
I mean, President Truman, you know, completely destroyed North Korea in like the most murderous bombing campaign in history, you know. Eisenhower threatened nuclear weapons, on and on and on. I mean, George Bush Sr. finally pulled U.S. nuclear weapons out of South Korea in 1991, but they were there for like 40 years. And, you know, North Korea has been under nuclear threat from the United States for 60 years. Mm-hmm. That's not a legitimate concern on their part. It's like they don't have any legitimacy whatsoever. And that's how a lot of people think, you know, towards Korea.
So, but Tim, one thing I wanted to ask you about this, as someone who hasn't lived in the U.S. much for a while, is how much of this do you think comes down to the provincial duel between Trump and liberal media, and how much of it is based on a real biased notion about Korea in general?
Well, I think it's both. And it was really strange because, you know, here I was, Trump tweeted something about, you know, we're going to meet with Kim Jong-un and try to end this thing or whatever. This is my first time I ever retweeted Trump with any kind of, like, you know, interest in what he was saying, right?
It's weird, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah, very weird. You know, my hands were dirty. and then the next day, like, he was ridiculing the press coverage of the whole thing. And I was looking at, you know, not just from his perspective, from my perspective, I could see them just, you know, I knew what the story was. I knew what the story was from North and South Korea, how they'd had these meetings and had come up with these proposals and presented them to the U.S. I knew all that was, you know, basically what happened. And yet the press just completely distorts it. And I'm like, I could see how he gets so angry at the press sometimes for that coverage, specifically on this, and how narrow their coverage and their questions is. At these briefings, it's just ridiculous.
So how are you going to bring peace? And which it's more like, how do you know you're not going to get played? How do you even know, you know, this or that? I mean, they're trying to like sort of trip him up or gotcha him rather than sort of trying to learn and do something positive or, you know, helpful towards peace. It's more like, how can we burn this guy? Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. And the other thing about the media is, 90% of the stories about the U.S. and North Korea over the last year have all been about like how a war will happen.
Right.
Well, this is what will happen. Right. And, you know, even if they'll conclude that it'll be a terrible war, it's all about the mechanics of how a war would take place
with graphics
and the results of that.
Yeah.
Nobody looks at the, you know, how a negotiation would take place, how diplomacy would take place, how diplomacy took place in the past, how the U.S. violated the agreements it had with North Korea. It's always like, oh, North Korea just violates every agreement, and therefore, you know, there's no even reason to talk about it. But in fact, you know, one of the reasons, one of the arguments, you know, for having a summit first is in building some kind of like understanding of, obviously the summit is going to lead to further negotiations. It's going to lay the groundwork for that. But like there are agreements that the U.S. and North Korea signed a joint statement in 2000 when, you know, the Clinton administration came very close to having an agreement with them where they were going to get rid of all their missiles. And that was basically a non-aggression agreement. And that, you know, that agreement's still there and the language is still there. There were agreements later. There was one in 2005 that was part of the 640 talks, which were the U.S., you know, promised, you know, it was like North Korea would pledge denuclearization. And there was, you know, U.S. promises of non-aggression and, you know, to move toward full diplomatic and economic relations. Mm-hmm. That's what the North Koreans thought they were getting in 94 to 99 to 2000. And in fact, you know, there was a movement toward that.
Right.
But then, you know, Bush just completely destroyed, you know, Bolton.
Yep.
You know, Bush came in with these neocons and they were determined to wreck the 94 agreement. And they did in 2002. And nobody in the press looks at that.
Yep.
Nobody. Yeah. I mean, nobody. I haven't seen anything about that in the New York Times, in the Washington Post. Any responsible, you know, reporting would do that, would dig into that history and dig out the truth of that history.
Yeah.
I mean, people pull out quote, all you got to do is read Bolton's book. I mean, Bolton talks about it plain, you know, I came to office with Bush to, you know, to get rid of this agreement.
Right.
And he seized on intelligence that they were building this uranium facility and, you know, getting equipment to, for uranium facilities, they use that to rip up the agreement. And so, you know, Bolton makes very clear. So like there's hasn't even been honest reporting about the history of this, which is really shameful. You know,
one thing we've talked about on this show many times. And one thing that I see when I look back over my lifetime, which has gone on far too long already, is that there's a lot of nostalgia for wars that were never going to happen. And in part, that's because there was a huge economic investment in them and there was good reason to keep the possibility alive. I mean, the obvious one is the Warsaw Pact versus NATO war that, if you looked carefully at it, was never going to happen because it didn't make any sense. If right. it did happen, it would have gone nuclear in a matter of minutes, and that would have been the end of pretty much everything. But for that very reason, it wasn't going to happen. And yet, I grew up as a war nerd reading Aviation Week and Space Technology and Armed Forces Journal and those things. And every week there would be a really beautiful, realistic battle painting mm-hmm. of a new weapon aimed at stopping these Warsaw Pact convoys because, you know, destroying the sea of tanks was the main thrust. Right. And all I knew is that you didn't get a lot of beautiful battle art from the, you know, from those years, except in those things. And I thought those ads were really cool, which is my problem. But anyway, there, what I didn't realize at the time is that there were trillions of dollars involved in that,
right.
and
yeah.
and thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of careers as well, and. The other war on the other hemisphere that was not going to happen but meant a lot to a lot of people is the DMZ in mm-hmm. Korea. Mm-hmm. You know, and you, I don't know, I'm just throwing this out here, but maybe one of the things we're seeing is a kind of nostalgia or regret for the idea that that very lucrative mm-hmm. pantomime might stop.
And it's going to – it'll be especially bad in terms of defense dollars for the missile defense industry, which I think is really counting on, you know, the North Korean quote unquote threat.
Right.
You know, they talk about, you know, this is our only defense, right? So there, the tons of money is being thrown into this missile defense, which everyone knows won't work anyway. Mm-hmm. But I mean, this, the amount of the military hardware in and around the Korean Peninsula is just, you know, incredible. And all these companies are, you know, reaping it, you know, earning a ton of money from it. But, you know, getting back to the media coverage, there is this infatuation, you know, with war. I guess it's easier to write about or something. It's more, you know, we're so used to it that, you know, it's easier to talk to military people about, you know, what would a war look like there and, you know, that kind of thing.
Cool graphics,
cool graphics. Yeah. that's the thing. Oh, yeah, the graphics, you know. And but the thing is, like, no, you know, reporting about, you know, the history of the U.S. and Korea or nothing. I mean, you know, like, you know, I saw, John, you know, you retweeted this thing I did, because, you know, they're observing the 70th anniversary of this Jeju uprising in South Korea, which was 1947.
I wanted to ask you about that. Yeah, if you could even
before the Korean War, right?
Right.
You know, 40,000 people on that island massacred by, you know, a U.S. supervised counterinsurgency. And there's still, you know, there's conferences that are happening, you know, next week in Chicago on this, and, you know, scholars, you know, looking at it, and like a lot of people that are still are survivors who are still around, still wanting the U.S. to apologize for its role there, you know. And there has been, you know, to some reporters' credit, you know, people, you know, looked at the bombing of North Korea during the Korean War, but not anything about what led up to the Korean War. It's just assumed, you know, it was just black and white situation. North Korea invaded, we help. Bullshit. You know, that's not how it happened.
Can you tell our listeners a you know, brief summary of what happened with the Jeju Uprising? So World War II ends, the U.S. takes over the South Korea, yeah. and the Soviets are sort of backing North Korea. So it is divided, right? Because that's where the troops were after the war. North Korea was actually had more of the industrial base at that time than South Korea. And if, you know, we talked about this, but anyway, this is pre-Korean War. The people that we empowered tended to be the collaborators, the collaborators with the Japanese,
exactly.
because they were anti-communist and easier right. and compromised, so we could control them more probably.
We put in power Syngman Rhee, who'd never lived in Korea, was this overseas, you know, independence guy, but he had, you know, ties to the fascist right. And mm-hmm. when he became president, the Korean constabulary, the police force, was composed almost entirely of police who'd been, you know, who were the Japanese colonial police. Mm. They were the enforcers for Japanese colonialism. And there were a lot of those police were kept in power. And the U.S. ran South Korea under a military government. U.S. military government was declared, which they didn't do in Japan. They ruled indirectly through the Japanese government in Japan, which was, you know, the enemy, right? Which attacked us. Southern Korea was just, you know, a victim of Japanese colonialism, and there had been resistance to Japan there.
Right.
So the U.S. kept these, constabulary in power, and was favoring anyone who was against. I mean, you know, no one wanted a permanent division. The U.S. began to look at anyone who was talking about a unified Korea as all obviously communists. Mm-hmm. And so anyone who was against, you know, permanent division was a communist. Hmm. And so in Jeju Island is the largest island in Korea, off the Korean Peninsula. It's south of South Korea. Mm-hmm. And that island, there's this rebellion began in 1947 when people in Jeju gathered on August 15th, 1947, to mark, you know, the liberation from Japan 2 years earlier, right? Mm-hmm. And at that rally, these Korean constabulary who were trained by the Japanese opened fire on the demonstration, and they killed people.
Wow.
And that led to an island-wide uprising where people, it's a very agricultural island, and they stormed police stations and, you know, killed a bunch of police, these collaborators, basically. Mm-hmm. And they seized control of a lot of the towns. And so this was seen as a direct threat to Syngman Rhee and the U.S. military government. And then there was this, during this time, there was also a plebiscite that Syngman Rhee put through, the U.S. wanted to have, like, do you vote for either unification or do you vote for division? And in Jeju was the only province, it's a single province as well, was the only province to vote against division and for unification.
Mm.
So they were seen, you know, because of this rebellion and this vote, they were seen as Red Island. In fact, the U.S. military government called that Red Island.
Oh, that's a death sentence right there. I mean,
there it is. Yeah. And what they did was they sent in reinforcements of these constabulary. And then there was all these North Korean guys who had fled North Korea because there was a revolutionary process in North Korea where landowners and, you know, big capitalists were deprived of their property.
Mm-hmm.
And they came to South Korea. So they were like this, like, super, you know, fascist, anti-communist death squads, basically.
Yeah.
And so they combined the constabulary and these North Korean death squads, sent them into Jeju, and they drew a line around the outer part of the island and said, anyone inside this red line, you're dead, basically. And so they told people to come to the coast. People came to the coast and were slaughtered anyway.
Jeez.
And then they just methodically went into the interior of the island and just slaughtered everybody. I mean, it was a mass slaughter. And, you know, many, many people left, you know, Jeju and fled to Japan.
Mm.
But this was an incredible, dirty war that lasted until the end of 1948, when, you know, they just killed so many people and imprisoned so many people. That, you know, the island was just, you know, was taken over. I mean, they lost. They couldn't stand up against this. And then, you know, the instant when the North Korean army decided in June 1950 to liberate the whole peninsula and they invaded and they came south, all these people from Jeju, these rebels who'd been imprisoned, were all executed, like, instantly.
Mm.
And there's lots of executions like that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, this was,
we don't hear anything about this over here.
We don't hear anything.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, the U.S. is always seen by most Americans as this great benevolent power in Korea. And we never know the history of these kinds of things. And the thing that's so sad for Koreans is that, you know, in Jeju, if you had anything to do, if your family had anything to do with this rebellion, you know, you're seen as a communist family, right? Mm-hmm. And under, you know, no one could tell the history You couldn't speak openly about this until there was democracy in the late 80s.
Right.
I mean, there was people that wrote about Jeju who were tortured to death by the Park Chung-hee regime.
Wow.
You know, I mean, so the history was completely suppressed, you know, as was the Gwangju uprising in 1980 until like 1988, you know. So, like, you know, the history, the thing that people don't understand in South Korea is that these histories only came to light really in the last, you know, 25, 30 years, mm-hmm. you know, because before that, it was impossible to talk openly about it and write openly about it. So there's all this hidden history that's come out. And of course, you know, people want restitution, want apology, and want to, you know, talk about the, you know, the role of the United States. And I think that that's what, you know, people don't understand mm-hmm. is there's just this, you know, that kind of feeling is still very strong in South Korea, this resentment against the U.S. as a foreign power and what it's done. I mean, there's a lot of, you know, respect for the United States. A lot of people like, you know, American music and culture and so on in South Korea. But the people, you know, are aware of this. I mean, it's, you know, people, there's in Jeju now, there's like groups that are really trying to make sure people understand, you know, this history. Mm-hmm. But it is it's a very sad history, and it's a terrible history.
It's very dark, and you've also and again, we know nothing about it. And you've been one of the most important journalists bringing to light what happened in Gwangju and the student uprising there in 1980, and specifically also Jimmy Carter's role in backing and encouraging the violent crackdown. Can you tell our listeners one more time briefly about that? And
In 1980, when, you know, there had been a military, this Park Chung-hee was a dictator for, you know, 18 years from 1961 till 1979. He was assassinated in the midst of widespread opposition and, you know, uprisings in different cities by industrial workers and students in 1979, in the middle of this huge crisis. In 79, he was shot to death by the head of his own CIA.
That's the weirdest story.
You know, who was trying to, you know, he thought that Park Chung-hee was gonna trigger a communist uprising.
Right.
So he shot him to death, right, to head this thing off. And then in the next, you know, then people saw the death of the dictator. It was like, that's the end of dictatorship, and let's have a democratic South Korea. And this was seen as kind of, you know, a problem for the U.S. because, you know, at the same time that just weeks before Park was assassinated, the Iranians had seized the U.S. embassy. So there was this huge crisis in Iran, right? And then suddenly there was this crisis in Korea, and they didn't want to have, I mean, Richard Holbrooke, who was the Assistant Secretary of State for East Asian and Pacific Affairs at the time, wrote documents that I later obtained saying, you know, we can't have another Iran in South Korea, so we got to keep the lid on, basically. Mm. And they really tried desperately to keep the progressive and revolutionary forces in South Korea from, you know, from fighting for a democracy. And during that time, as people began to demonstrate and workers began to go on wildcat strikes, you know, against all these dictatorial laws that had been in place and system that had been in place for years, you know, another general began a rolling coup, and he took over various parts of the national security apparatus in South Korea, starting with the Korean CIA. And then in May 17th, 1980, he seized power in a military coup. And when they're in the middle of more massive demonstrations in the city of Gwangju in the south, which had always been a hotbed of resistance to, you know, Japanese colonial rule and dictatorship, people stayed demonstrating in the streets. And Chun Doo-hwan, this new general who took over, sent these paratroopers down there, and they just attacked these students in the most vicious way over two or three days, and started slaughtering people in the streets, beating them and kicking them to death and stabbing them with bayonets. And the town was horrified in seeing what was happening. I mean, they weren't just attacking students. They were killing people in their homes. Mm. You know, middle-aged people, older people were killed too. And so the whole town rose up against the military. And then, you know, one day when there was, you know, a few tens of thousands of people were like surrounding the military that was in front of the provincial capital in Gwangju, the military knelt down and they just started shooting into the crowd. Wow. For hours. They shot. Jeez. And that day, about 60 people were slaughtered and you know, hundreds and hundreds injured. And the next day, May 22nd, 1980, Carter's national security team meets at the White House and they discuss the situation in Gwangju and they decide they have to put down this rebellion against the military, even though they knew the military had been responsible for it and slaughtered all these people. They said, okay, we have no choice but to support Chen Duan, and they did. Mm-hmm. And then they aided the takeover of Chun and the ending of this uprising. Mm. And it took me years to get, but I got by 1996, I had gotten under the Freedom of Information Act documents showing that the U.S. had actually basically given the green light for a coup, saying, you know, we would understand why you would need to use military to put down student uprisings and labor uprisings. Of course, they didn't give them orders to, you know, kill the people in Gwangju. That was up to the Korean general. But even though that happened, they still looked aside and supported that general to take over the city once the city citizens rebelled against it.
That language just,
disgraceful.
That diplomatic language. I mean, people know how to read what the U.S. is saying. When the U.S. is against something, they're pretty generally, you know, the messages that are communicated are pretty direct. And when we approve of something but don't want to be directly responsible, you know, it's sort of like we won't, you know, look down on, or there's certain kind of semi-passive language constructions that are used that are meant and read as an absolute green light. I mean, I've just been reading about Yeltsin's the way he bombed and burnt down his own parliament in 1993, and we gave every positive signal Yeltsin was looking for, you know, short of saying yes, kill them all, but you know,
right.
We gave it very similar. The language that the Clinton administration gave was very similar.
Restoration of security.
Exactly.
Restoration of calm.
Exactly.
Et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. The forces of
this
good.
Kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And like, you know, Jimmy Carter, you know, when he was finally, you know, there was a press conference after the uprising was put down, and Daniel Shore, to his credit, asked him on CNN, you know, doesn't this kind of violate your, you know, support for human rights? Mm-hmm. And he said, absolutely not. You know, you can't have human rights if there's going to be a communist takeover.
Jeez.
He actually said,
wow,
this was a communist takeover. I guess, you know, wow, this is what he was told by the CIA or, you know, his advisors and by Holbrooke. So he really apparently believed this.
Yeah.
And I've always thought that his, you know, I mean, Carter did go on to play a very important role in 94 when he almost single-handedly stopped this war that was going to happen between the U.S. and North Korea. And, you know, getting back to Bill Perry, the former defense secretary, I mean, he said at that time he thought it was like a 50-50 chance they were going to go to war. But, you know, Perry had gotten, you know, talked to Japan, South Korea, was getting forces in place, and, you know, to do a massive attack on the North Korean nuclear facility at Yongbyon. And Jimmy Carter met with Kim Il-sung, and that was the beginning of that agreement. They hammered out an agreement there, and then Kim Il-sung died, and then it was made with his son. And I always have thought that maybe, you know, Carter had a little bit of guilt in him about this, but I don't think so. But, you know, I saw him interviewed the other day on CBS News yesterday, and they talked about his legacy, and he's like, well, I think, you know, my legacy was, you know, human rights and et cetera. You know, not in Korea, not in the Philippines, not in Indonesia, not in Iran, not in lots of places. You know, he was just, he did not enforce that at all.
Yeah.
And,
well, there's an interesting parallel, and I'm not sure it's valid, but I mean, as if the U.S. had a habit of displacing to East Asia aggression that wasn't feasible in the area that they were really worried about, like Cuba. The ending of the missile crisis means they agree not to invade Cuba. So suddenly they start getting very aggressive in Southeast Asia. And Iran, Carter decides for whatever reason that he can't retaliate directly against Iran, and that means somehow that we have to compensate by being more aggressive in this other East Asian sphere.
Mm. So the toughness, mm-hmm. it's always there.
One thing,
maybe that's what Bolton's about.
Yeah, I mean, so one thing, you know, the Clinton agreement, I mean, I'm trying to think about lessons here. If, assuming it works out, I guess, you know, another purpose for Bolton could be, hey, if you don't come to an agreement, I'm going to have to start listening to this guy. So, you know, you better come to an agreement, but then there might not be an agreement, then what? But I was going to say, you know, the Clinton agreement, I mean, that should be, that it worked, as you said, for a while. It worked pretty well, and then the Bush administration came in determined to rip it up. Started with that 2000, it started probably before then, but certainly with the Axis of Evil speech. Suddenly, you know, North Korea appeared in that. They were determined to rip up that agreement, and look what happened. North Korea just went on and made nukes, and now they have ICBMs and nukes. It was a disaster.
That's right.
And Trump,
it was a disaster.
Yeah, and Trump meanwhile is determined to rip up Obama, which is one of Obama's. You know, there are a lot of things to criticize about Obama. That was certainly one of his best achievements, I think, was the agreement with Iran as well as opening up Cuba. And he seems to be determined to undo both of those.
Destroy both of them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, so I mean, I'm just wondering, like, if so let's say that Trump does get an agreement here. I look at it like, knowing the way that this country and certainly the way the kind of foreign policy wonks think, they're going to think, oh, the reason there was a peace deal by Trump is sort of Nixon to the 10th power. It's because Trump put on such a crazy act and was so close to firing off nukes that the North Koreans were forced to the table. You know, this is how they're going to spin it. And then the idea is going to be, well, in all future future sort of standoffs, what we got to do is we have to have a credible threat that we're going to nuke the entire world if we want to have peace. When in fact, as you're talking about, Tim, it's very local what happened here. I mean, we, you know, Trump is playing a role in it, obviously, but what's really the, you know, the main driver behind this is the election of President Moon in right. South Korea.
And he's got about 75% support now in South Korea,
mm-hmm.
you know, and that's because of what he's done with North Korea. People want to have peace.
Yeah.
You know, they want to end this. That's because, I mean, people there have been feeling under the threat of war for a long time now, especially over the last year. It got really tense mm-hmm. and people were really, you know, it's even like lots of mainstream reporters pointed out. You know, you talk to your average South Korean, they were far more worried about Trump than they were about Kim Jong-un.
Right.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
I'm sure that's the case. Well, Tim, thanks so much again for coming on the show and you know, elucidating what's going on here with the upcoming Trump meeting. And, you know, hopefully it'll work out. I mean, we're not in that corner that's hoping it's all going to fail to, you know, to validate our whatever our politics. I mean, it should succeed. I think everybody should hope it should succeed. Whatever.
Yeah,
else.
I think so too. Yeah. And by the way, I'm gonna try to raise money so I can cover the actual summit because I think
that would be
very interesting to be there.
Well, we'll push it on through Twitter and through the Facebook.
Yeah, tell us what we can do.
Yeah,
I will. I'm gonna put up a Patreon page so I can do it and try to raise money here and in South Korea because I think it's really important to have a reporter on the ground there who's not going to be one of these mainstream hacks.
Yeah.
You know,
somebody besides Richard Engel, you know.
Somebody besides Richard Engel parachute into Korea, you know.
Yeah.
And get brain fed by the Pentagon, whatever their line is, or whatever the CIA line. Actually, I think he's been listening to the CIA pretty much to, you know, but.
Well, that's the pattern. The Pentagon is the sane one these days.
So. That's right.
Yeah.
I know I've seen articles in the last couple of days like, you know, let's hope that Mattis stays because he's the only voice of sanity. Like, why, now we're putting all our trust in a Marine general. Well, okay. That's America in 2018.
Exactly. All right.
Okay, thank you,
Tim. Thank you again. That's Tim.
Thank you so much.
All right. Great. Thanks, Tim. That's Tim Shorrock. He's the national security reporter for The Nation magazine and the author of Spies for Hire, The Secret World of Intelligence Outsourcing. Thanks again, Tim.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Bye-bye. Okay, so that was Tim Shorrock. Great interview with Tim. Yeah. I mean, really, we're lucky that he's one of our first, right when we first started doing interviews, he was one of our very first guests. And kind of, so if people have been following the show, I'm thinking, you know, you'll have a sort of better understanding than your average idiot out there about Korea and what's going on there. Yeah.
Nicholas Kristof.
Yes. Or, you know, Maddow fans. God, what an embarrassment, yeah, you know?
I know. She really astonishes me.
Yeah.
I just don't get it.
You know what's kind of astonishing? I mean, I was thinking about this while we were talking, but so, you know, at first I kind of grew up or you know, came into consciousness, let's say in, you know, mid-70s, mid-late-70s, when a standard liberal was further to the left than a liberal now, today is. But nevertheless, a liberal stood for anti-CIA, anti-war, anti-empire, wasn't necessarily, you know, too friendly with communists, but was definitely against kind of empire and the national security state. And then when liberals kind of reappeared as a force, again, a political force, it would have been after within a year after the Iraq war, the Iraq invasion, and when it went bad, and they suddenly became very active again and seemed to kind of link up with their 70s counterparts. And so kind of, you know, contemporary liberalism and liberalism of my childhood were on the opposite end of all this CIA empire neocon worshiping. And I know the reality is different, but at least publicly that's kind of, it's just really bizarre and counter narrative and depressing. Yeah. Anyway.
And then to see the Trump fans savaging the CIA and FBI.
Weird.
Like, what?
I know. Now that's weird. Yeah. That's when she gets.
Those are cop groupies from way back.
I know.
I mean, to quote HST's attorney once again, I know those people in my goddamn blood. They cheer when cops shoot somebody. And now they're snarling at the CIA and FBI. It's just too weird.
You know, the thing is, the right can very easily go back without much shame or you know, without being stained too much. They can easily go back to their pro-cop, pro-spook authoritarian ways. But in my mind, like liberals, it's harder for them to say, to just go back to being in any event, in any way credible anti-war, anti-militarist, anti-CIA after this. Like, you know, there was something on the line and they had to show what their principles were. And their principles were, we love the CIA. We love coups. You know, what are you talking about? So in my mind, it's much more damaging than the liberal left, whatever you'd call it. Anyway, so just as we were going to the show, again, there's always something. Trump just expelled 60 Russian diplomats and shut down the Seattle consulate, which is going to hurt, you know, a lot of emigres and green card or whatever who live in the Pacific Northwest, in response to the nerve agent poisoning of Skripal and his daughter Yulia Skripal in London. And it was sort of announced, it was clearly coordinated with a bunch of countries in the EU. Germany expelled, I don't know, four or five. A bunch of other countries expelled a few Russian diplomats. I think 13 or 14 countries total. Ukraine expelled 13 diplomats, which begs the question, why do they have 13 Russian diplomats there if they're at war with them? But then you remember, anyway, these guys are all doing business with each other while they're fighting wars. And it's just it's a little messier, let's say, the Russian-Ukraine conflict than
it's like strange to me in so many ways. For one thing, it's a real 20th century echo, like, you know, that some spy scandal breaks in the 1970s and the U.S. or the U.K. expels 37 Russians. There's always a very specific number and you never know where it came from.
Yeah.
And then the Soviet Union, as it was then, expels 37 U.S. or U.K. Diplomats, and there's something oddly ballet-like about it. Only in this case, I don't quite understand it, because this was between the U.K. and Russia. If it was the Russian government, I have no idea. Mm-hmm. And I was surprised that the U.S. would go all in to the extent of expelling 60 because that's a lot in these numbers.
It is. I think, John, we've talked about this from the beginning. I think the best you could say about Trump in terms of Russia relations is that, let's say for a year, it wasn't as bad as it might have been the first year in Hillary. But we've always said from the beginning, first of all, this idea that America First would somehow make Trump a anti-war or pacifist was bogus. And secondly, because Trump had this kind of bad stain on him of being too pro-Russian, as you used to make this comparison a lot to the Tigray leadership in Ethiopia, they felt more compelled to go to war with Eritrea than maybe if their leadership was from a different
ethnic group. An Amharic leader would have been. Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
And to prove that they are more patriotic. And one thing Trump can't do because of his ego and so on is say, I was wrong about Russia or Putin. I still think, again, that it would be a good thing if they weren't ramping up Cold War pressures, but you can't do that in D.C., and he can't do it, definitely, because of the whole Russiagate, political pressure. So he's now, on the one hand, he can't openly say, I was wrong, but on the other hand, he's moving way to the right of where the Obama administration was, has approved lethal offensive weapons, anti-tank weapons to Ukraine and other weapons, which Obama didn't do, and going hog wild and expelling on putting, sanctioning powerful Russians and so on. So we're having a much more, as one might call it, an anti-Russian or hard on Russia administration, just in the rhetoric area, but in actual policy, yes.
Yeah.
So, that's it. I don't want to get too deep into the Skripal thing. We can do it maybe in another show. But we did talk about it a bit, a couple shows before when the very first news came out about the poisoning. So this Novichok poison was used. I remember this is one of the most famous mob hits in the 90s in the Yeltsin era, 1994 or 5. Ivan, I can't remember his last, he was Georgian, Kivalidi, I think his name was. He was a, quote unquote banker and a big time mobster, also tied in with some of the liberal young reformers, by the way, backed one or two of them. I'd have to go back through my notes on that. And I remember he was killed. I remember the reports at the time, there was something smeared on his phone and he and his secretary, his receptionist, both died. They were spitting up a milky substance, I remember being the way it was described, and went into comas and then died. And apparently, so that was Novichok also. Personally, I'd still say, God knows I don't want to believe it or whatever, and I don't want any new Cold War stuff, but to me, I wouldn't put policy on this, but if I were a gambling man, I'd say there's a Russian, intelligence link to this hit one way or another. One theory is Putin has kind of created a new policy of plausible deniability. So kind of farming out without specific instructions, kind of more general instructions to more private interests to do certain jobs. And this is just a consequence of that. Like it was a bungled hit on a traitor. And Skripal, gave up apparently something like 300 agents. That's one possibility. There, other possibilities. I don't believe the false flag one still. It could be just something screwed up. Who knows? Maybe Skripal was involved in something. Another plausible theory I think that I've heard is that Skripal, the poison was found in his house. In fact, that's where the British police inspector himself was poisoned, who seems to have survived, was in Skripal's house. And so there's another theory that sort of out of work GRU people or mobsters, because again, a Russian mobster was already killed with this Novichok nerve agent in the 90s. Maybe Skripal was involved, as ex-spooks or semi-spooks tend to be, on some kind of side deal to transport or hand over this Novichok to his British handlers, or who knows, or to sell to another mafia group or another country. And what was bungled was the handling of it in his house. That's a possibility. And then this would have been exploited no matter what happened, it's definitely being exploited by the British government and the conservative government and the whole sort of Cold War lobby. They love this. And, you know, as we know from the past, with the shooting down of the KL, the Korean airliner flight 007 in 1983, the shooting down was real, but the propaganda story created around it was massively fabricated to present the Soviet Union, what they did, in the worst and most, you know, slanted light possible, that had nothing to do with what actually happened, for geopolitical reasons. And that could definitely be happening here.
Right.
After the Litvinenko poisoning, which I'm pretty damn sure was, the links to the Russian state were pretty clear, I think, on that one. I think you got to go with there was something there. And the fact that it was bungled says to me it was FSB. I don't know. but it's a terrible thing. And it's, you know, it's only just making the world worse. So anyway, let's leave that one alone for now. Let's turn to Turkey and Afrin, you know, what the latest is there, and in Izgura in Syria.
Yeah, well, let's start with Afrin. Mm-hmm. It will help if people have the map of the Afrin area with them. So most serious Syria watchers will know about the site called Syria Live Map. But if you don't know that, just Google Syria Live Map and you'll get a control map showing who owns what in Syria. Mm-hmm. I've been following this for years, but it's pretty easy to use even if you're new to it. Afrin is the northwest corner of Syria, just inside from Hatay, a Turkish province that also used to be Syrian. So go to the northwest corner and keep clicking the plus sign to make it more and more close up until you are on Afrin province. If you did that, say, a week ago, you would have seen that in spite of all the bellicose noise from Erdogan and the Turkish state, they hadn't really penetrated very far, but into this vertical rectangle, let's say, that is Afrin, one of the three, well, original three Kurdish cantons in northern Syria. Now the only one outside the main block of Rojava, the Kurdish proto-state, let's say, in northern Syria. So they had only taken the border areas of this rectangle of Afrin, and they were not moving very quickly. And then the movement happened very suddenly. They moved into Afrin town, which was the main target. And if you read the Turkish rhetoric, it sounds like Afrin was this giant metropolis that they completely overran. Afrin was never a big town. It was a small rural town. The whole canton only originally had a population of 200,000. But at any rate, they finally entered Afrin. And as I said in the last show, I thought, well, entering a town in Syria in this war is not the same as taking it, as we saw in Kobani, as we saw in Aleppo, Deir ez-Zor, a lot of towns. But it seems like the YPG in Syria decided to get out. There was no resistance, as far as I can tell, in the town of Afrin. And at this point, again, if you look at the Syria Live map, you'll see that it's all in a sort of vomity light green, which is kind of appropriate.
Yeah.
Because now the Turkish state and their wretched jihadi refuse allies have overrun the whole rectangle, all of Afrin. So that means that there's a weird little enclave to the south and east mm-hmm. of that Afrin rectangle. And the main town in that little triangle is Tal Rifat. And Erdogan's new boast is that the next goal will be to take Tal Rifat. And if he does that, then all that's left, Afrin and its neighboring areas will be all gone. All that's left is the part of Rojava that pushed west across the river into Manbij. We heard about the Manbij campaign from Patrick a couple of episodes ago. And Erdogan has been talking about taking Manbij, and it's beginning to look like the U.S. might let Turkey and its little scuzzy friends do that. It's beginning to look like they've made some sort of deal that Rojava will only exist east of the river. And who knows, they'll probably sell that out too eventually. But it looks like they will definitely let the Turkish state take Tal Rifat and maybe take Manbij as well, which would be a shame because we talked about some of the people who died and were maimed trying to take Manbij back from Islamic State. And it's a grim picture. I mean, the kids of the YPG and YPJ have, and later the SDF, have served as the U.S.'s cannon fodder in northern Syria. And the only reliable allies, the only ones you didn't have to be ashamed of in Syria, even as the CIA kept trying to push its full-on Sunni sectarian friends.
In fact, remember, I'm just thinking about this now. The way that Patrick described it, Manbij, the attack on Manbij was something that was almost, I wouldn't say forced on the Kurds by the Obama administration, but it seems that powers, outside powers, wanted them to go after Manbij rather than something else. Like, this was an important job for the SDF, yeah. YPGJ to
he thought they'd be heading south to Raqqa.
Yeah, yeah.
And they were urged,
yeah,
as in, we won't give you any more ammo until you do this. They were urged to move west instead.
Yeah.
Not south, but west into Manbij.
And suffered a lot of casualties for it. And now, I mean, it's... there are already very strong, you know, hints coming from the U.S. and leaks to the Washington Post and so on that, and now it's got to be given up. Sorry,
it's, yep.
Grim stuff. Yeah,
it's very grim. And Turkey's progression toward outright fascism continues. At the same time, I mean, there are hundreds, if not thousands, of Turkish writers and intellectuals in prison for failing to approve Erdogan's policies. And now, after dueling demonstrations on a major Turkish university, one pro-invasion demonstration handing out little sweets for the conquest of Afrin by tame Islamist students, and the other one by about seven very brave students saying they objected to the conquest of Afrin. Erdogan called all the ones who objected commies and traitors and
terrorists.
Mm-hmm. You have the horrible feeling that Turkey, Erdogan is popular in Turkey. There's mm-hmm. there's no way to hide that fact. And you have the feeling that, well, you know, I grew up when Reagan came to power before mm-hmm. he became president by insulting and promising to take revenge on those Berkeley students. And so it all has a horrible, endless repetition feel to it. And as I've said before, there's a weird analogy between Turkish and American politics that you don't see elsewhere in the world. And this all seems grimly familiar. This is right-wing demagogue popularity. You stage a war on somebody you can easily beat, and you demonize those uppity students.
Mm-hmm. And it works. Further south, it looks like East Ghouta is pretty much back in government hands. It's about 90%+. And a lot of that was bombing, but a lot of that was also deals being cut with the different militia groups and getting civilians out. And,
it's been a kind of a downer for most media because
You
got the feeling they were eager to report on prospective massacres as they were in Aleppo. And instead, The whole Ghouta thing, when it was clear that the SAA, Hezbollah, and friends were going to win in Ghouta, the whole thing resolved into a series of negotiations ending in bus convoys. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's no pathos in a bus convoy. Well, unless it gets bombed, like the bus convoy of Shia refugees. And then there was no pathos for the press in that because they were the wrong people.
Yeah, and it looks like what's going to be next is going to be the Daraa province on the border with Jordan, also going to the border with the Golan Heights, with Israeli occupied Golan Heights.
And, yeah, that's one of the places the whole cycle of demonstrations and armed uprisings began.
Right.
Way back in 2011, and now it's next on target, and eventually, you know, the SAA, Hezbollah, PMU, Hazara mercenaries, all those guys, they're going to run out of targets that are completely safe, and they're going to probably turn to the diagonal chunk of Syria that is Rojava.
Yeah.
But they may also turn to the northwestern chunk that is now de facto annexed by Turkey. So mm-hmm. it's going to get interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm just looking at the Syria map here. So you also have these two little gray blobs left. I mean, you remember a couple of years ago, like there were these sort of moving maps of how Islamic State spread and spread and spread, and controlled. It was exaggerated always because most of the territory. I mean, there were a few major cities, Mosul being the main one, and Raqqa.
Yeah,
but generally it was a lot of desert area. But you still do see these two gray Islamic State blobs. And for some reason, it's kind of neat how how the media decides to separate Islamic State from rebels. I mean, it's had a strange effect, though, of normalizing Al-Qaeda and making Al-Qaeda seem like just a rebel group, you know.
Or Jaish al-Islam.
Al-Alush
said long ago, Alawites, we will cleanse Syria of your evil presence. And yeah, but it's Islamic State just set the bar so high for sectarian craziness that it's kind of easy to make anybody else look like a moderate.
I mean, yeah, you wonder if there's going to be that scene, I forget what that British show was called, are we the baddies as they're sitting there? wait a minute, Islamic State, are we the baddies?
Mitchell and Webb.
Mitchell and Webb, yeah, they'd be with their black flag, you know, black Islamic State flag.
Yeah. Heads on spikes.
Yes. Yeah. Wait a minute. All right. So let's move on from there to Yemen. And so I guess yesterday was the third anniversary of the start of the U.S.-UK-backed Saudi-UAE-led war on the Houthi Shia rebels in the west and north of the country of Yemen. And So the Houthis. I mean, I don't know. You gotta. It's hard
It's getting to be a tradition. You know, corn on the cob, tailgate picnics, and lob a few Burkan, which is a Scud derivative missiles, toward the Riyadh airport.
Tailgate parties, yeah, and I mean, and there really was. It's hard to deny the comedy of it, like watching those. Patriots, its alleged anti-missile batteries, firing off like fireworks, and one of them just getting scoring an own goal.
If people haven't seen that video, you got to see it, because all it needs is some Looney Tunes voiceovers. Yeah. Because somebody is shooting this probably from a cell phone. One Patriot goes up and disappears, and you don't know what happened to that. And then the next Patriot, they're following its trajectory upward, and then it makes like a 160-degree turn and blasts right down on the ground somewhere inside Riyadh, and it's almost as if somebody there insulted it or something like that.
it saw a woman walking, you know, without an accompanying male, or maybe a woman driver or something like
and it makes a surprisingly big explosion, which has surprised me, because there's been a lot of argument now about whether Patriots work and how Patriots work, and this is something that I wrote about a long time ago, but maybe a lot of our people are new, and they don't know the background on this, but the Patriot goes way back to a time in the late 70s when the U.S. was actually trying to reverse engineer a bunch of Soviet weapons like surface-to-air missiles, because they had a weird, totally delusional inferiority complex towards the Soviet military. And they wanted a surface-to-air missile of their own, so they came up with the Patriot. It was going to be better in all these different ways. But it was designed from the beginning to bring down manned fighters, MiGs, basically. And a manned fighter aircraft is one of the most fragile contraptions ever put together. A good load of seagulls can crash it. So the Patriot was designed with a relatively small proximity warhead. That is, when it got close to what it thought was the target, it would shoot a bunch of ball bearings, basically, out of a small explosive charge, like any anti-personnel bomb. And if one of those ball bearings hit a sensitive area on a fighter, which was just about anywhere on a 1970s fighter, it would go down. But then they realized slowly and grudgingly, nobody wants to play dueling fighters with us. Nobody's ever wanted to play that with us. What we get instead, and what we first got in the first Gulf War, was Scuds, these gigantic, unguided missiles that were just lobbed in the general direction of the target according to simple Euclidean geometry. Give it X amount of fuel, point it at Y angle, and it will go Z number of kilometers, and that will be the city that you want to obliterate. They were used in the Iran-Iraq War, then they were used against Israeli targets in the first Gulf War. And there was tons of publicity, if older viewers remember, when they landed in Israel, they were cheered and all this. But the thing is, they weren't designed to bring down a big, giant rock like that. It's like trying to shoot down an asteroid. It's not so easy.
Yeah.
So often they'd explode these little proximity warheads, and it's like, take that, Scud! And the Scud, this giant zombie wouldn't even notice and would just continue on its simple Euclidean path. So there have been several attempts to remake the Patriot since then. The Saudis are apparently using Patriot 2, which are basically just a refined version of that original design. They also have Patriot 3, and the third version is kind of the more interesting design. It's got a better radar system, and it's got a kinetic warhead, meaning a big lump of heavy metal that's meant to use that advanced radar to impact the Scud, not explode near it like a proximity warhead, but bash into it and at least deflect it. So it'll hit the suburbs, you know, rather than the city. Or in this case, it'll hit, you know, some low-rent immigrant district of Riyadh rather than Riyadh Airport, where people who matter are actually getting flights. But the ones that were fired over Riyadh this time seem to have been Patriot 2s, which means they may not have done anything at all. They may have just peppered these giant second-generation Scuds with a few pellets, which would have made no difference because the Scud has no mind.
Right.
It's an unguided missile.
Okay, that makes that explains it, because the videos that I saw, besides the one, the own goal one, is it looked like what you said, like basically like a fireworks show trying to throw up as much kind of fireworks flak as possible. I mean, it was kind of crude and simple, and it, as far as I know, it didn't hit. None of them were hit. But the one, like, they went up in the air, and then they kind of exploded in this shower of orange, you know, little flying lights. It looked like it just put up a whole bunch of flak everywhere, like old anti-aircraft, you know. And it also seems to kind of defeat the purpose. I mean, if you can actually blow it up, okay, that makes sense. But it would seem to me, look, the missiles are not going to, you know, knock out the command and control center and win the war. The missiles have one purpose, and that is to exact a kind of civilian cost terror, you know, what we call terrorism. Yeah. And so if you let them get to Riyadh and then you try to shoot them down there, I mean, haven't you already partly lost the battle in that sense? Like, you know, and then of course half of your Patriots go zooming right back at you.
That's the thing with flak. Your own flak is going to come down.
Yeah.
I mean, you don't send the, I mean, maybe they're supposed to explode it. Traditional flak is supposed to explode at a certain altitude, but a lot of them didn't. And they came back down and smashed into your own city. And yeah, Patriot, most of the missile is going to come down and it's going to do damage of its own. And yeah, as you say, when you do that kind of light show, you're already announcing that the Houthi,
yes,
miserably poor, half-starved rebels of one of the poorest countries in the world, where, you know, who are being starved to death as we speak, can still launch giant missiles at one of the wealthiest cities in the world.
Yeah. It's it means they're kind of winning with that. I'm going to read just very briefly from your article on the Scuds. It's the Warnerd. Scuds, this is from Pando. Scuds and Patriots, the armies of this age are weird. And that's a bit from a line from Gene Wolfe, right?
Right.
And I just like this line here. The Scud and the Patriot, they're like the sperm whale and the giant squid, or Mormillo and Retarius, which I didn't know that. Yes. I looked it up and saw it. Archetypes who've been fighting on some astral plane since the Big Bang. The Patriot is one of the best known and least understood weapons in the U.S. arsenal. It's the Brad Dourif of surface-to-air missiles. Very good at what it was designed to do, but continually miscast, forced to do roles it wasn't meant to handle. And I mean, that's a great line. Like,
I'm a Brad Dourif fan. What can I
yeah. And then of course, you know, so we have the third anniversary of this horrible war, you know, which is being massively underreported in the media. You know, the media has officially kept it at 10,000 dead since August of 2016. So for over a year and a half, not one person has died, even though there's the world's worst cholera epidemic and famine crisis, certainly less in several decades. Nobody wants that death toll to go up, and therefore
I'm working on a newsletter where I'm trying to figure out what the real death toll might be. I had some problems this week and I haven't gotten it done, but I'll try to have it out soon. And the numbers, when you look at them, when you look at the death rate for untreated cholera and consider that the number of cases in Yemen has been estimated at almost a million, it's pretty horrific.
Yeah. Yeah, and on top of that, there have been boycotts with U.S. direct help and medical goods coming in. The Saudis and UAE have been bombing hospitals. I mean, so they can't even get medical care to all these people suffering from cholera. So it's not like cholera and then treat them. It's cholera plus, you know, blockade. I mean, not boycott, but blockade.
And diphtheria, all these diseases that are extinct in places that have normal delivery of medical care, they're coming back with a vengeance in Yemen, and that's because they're intended to.
Mm-hmm. It's a form of warfare, grim old form of warfare. And on that note, we'll go to our last theater of war, and potentially this could be really the grimmest of them all if it really comes back the way it once was, which is the Congo. I mean, you know, we don't have enough time left to go really deep in this, but John, you wanted to talk a little bit about what's happening, because there are a few different provinces that are kind of heating up, and you're seeing already, you know, mass movements of people and in the eastern provinces, northeastern provinces. And
yeah, we talked briefly about whatever is going on in Kasai, in sort of south central DRC Congo. But now there's been a flare-up in Ituri, which is northeastern Congo. I mean, I remember long ago, Ituri was the site of the Ituri pygmies, the Ituri forest pygmies of the rainforest, who were what my generation believed were the good people. You know how every generation has to have a group that it thinks of as the good people. This guy named Colin Turnbull wrote a book called The Forest People. And idealized the Pygmies, as they were called then, the Trois, as peaceful, non-hierarchical hunter-gatherers who never made war, never even raised their voices with each other. But they were they're the underclass of northeastern Congo. They're often enslaved, sometimes even eaten. And the people who matter in Ituri now are big people in every sense. And what seems to be happening now is a conflict between two groups, the Hema and the Lendu, who are enacting the oldest pattern of warfare in the world. They're raiding each other's villages, killing each other's people when they can. And what makes that such a strange echo of ancient human patterns is that one of them is pastoralist, one of the peoples who make their living with cattle and think of cattle as the only wealth that matters and think of herd care as the only job worth having. And the other are farmers. And this, I mean, if you know the Cain and Abel story from the Bible, I mean, Cain is the older brother and the farmer, and he kills Abel, who's the herdsman, for all kinds of weird, murky reasons. That's, I mean, you'd know better than me, Mark, but I think that's the early part of the Old Testament,
it is,
right?
Where yes.
Grim, horrible things happen and you don't quite know why.
Yeah. Yeah, God's really Yahweh's way in the background. And yeah. It's just, it's a pretty grim, yeah.
So that has been explained by various scholars as an account of the early wars between herding peoples, livestock peoples, and agricultural peoples in the Middle East. And we're seeing that kind of warfare start up now in Ituri in the Northeast. And that's on top of the massive flood of Hutu refugees, including a whole lot of genocidaires from Rwanda who flooded into eastern Congo and were pursued there by Tutsi avengers from Rwanda. And then there's the Hutu and Tutsi who had always lived in Congo but who see themselves as somewhat distinct. And all these populations are at war with each other. And the DRC army is a joke. It's always been a joke. People who are involved in this Hema Lendu mutual massacre now say you run to the DRC army and they say you better run away, but they run away before you can, which is what the DRC army usually does.
Well, and then also you have Kabila's trying to change the constitution so he could stay in power. So I think you have a little bit more instability. I mean, it's already an incredibly unstable place, but I think that's even added a bit more to it.
Yeah. Yeah. This is, Kabila too. This
yes.
is, Joseph, not Laurent. Joseph is apparently just as useless as his dad, who was criticized by Che Guevara half a century ago. Che went looking for revolutionaries
yes.
in Congo, and he met Laurent and said in some letter back to Cuba, like, all this guy talks about is chorus girls in Paris and the best hotels there. What the hell kind of revolutionary is this?
Yeah. Yeah. That's...
And Joseph is apparently a chip off the old block.
Yeah, that's, I think we briefly alluded to it. That was when Che went out and there was this bizarre war, kind of other war out in the very east of Congo, where sort of pro-Batista, anti-Castro Cuban pilots backed by the CIA were fighting Che Guevara's rebels out in Congo. It's a weird story. Potential subject for a future episode, too.
Definitely, actually.
Yeah. So anyway, I think we should just keep an eye on what's yeah. going on there, because it does seem to be, you know, descending. Hopefully that, you know, the momentum on that will not keep picking up. Hopefully the momentum of that will be stopped. I mean, people have seen what happened, you know, in one of the articles I think I sent to you, John, for our notes, you know, it's generally accepted wisdom that about 5 million people died in the
yeah.
Congo War. I mean, it was essentially like a Africa war in the from 1998 to about 2002 or four, whenever they decided ended, 2, 3, 4, 5 million people. So it's the deadliest war since World War II, and most of them died from starvation or from diseases. And that's why it's so important to, when we talk about Yemen, to understand how and why famine and disease are weapons of war, and that the casualties of those weapons of war should be tallied along with actual people killed by bombs.
Right, which is one of the reasons that the 10,000 dead farce in Yemen is so disgusting, because yeah, people must know better.
Yeah, they do. All right, and I think on that super grim note, I think it's time to wrap up. And the next next show, you'll be here in the U.S. And so, and
yeah, back to NYC with some, I hope, some good info on the great sights of Lisbon.
Good. All right. Thanks, John. Thank you, Brendan. Okay. And thank you again to all of our great subscribers at Radio Warnerd. Until next month.
Thanks, Mark. Thanks, Brendan. Bye.
Bye.